Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Today we're in lesson 154. And at the end of last lesson, we're discussing the commission of Eliezer and the way he began to tell of his commission to the family of Abraham in Haran. And basically, the way he did it is in the manner and the custom of the Middle East. It may seem to be a little bit strange in other societies who are not used to it, but in those societies, especially in the Middle East, some other societies may do likewise, before you come to business, so to speak, you know, to the core of the matter, you discuss the family, you give a lot of details, you give the background. In other words, the whole thing has to be very family-like, personable, and so it is to this very day. A lot of American corporations have learned that they've had a lot of difficulties going to the Middle East and doing business because they were trying to do it the American way. And then finally, they got to the point where they had to hire counselors from the Middle East to show them how to do business there, and basically they coach them how to deal with their Arab counterparts. The first thing you do, you talk about the family, they ask you about your wife, your children, how is everybody doing, and matters like that. And when all that is settled and a common background has been established and a family relationship, so to speak, has been brought up, then only at the end they deal with the matter itself, the business part of it, which is the smallest part. In other words, hospitality, that's a part of the hospitality, is an art in that society, and it's extremely important to them, because they want to deal with you as a human being, as a person, not just as a stranger or a business partner that has no personal relationship whatsoever. And so anyway, this is what he's doing here, and we have many examples like that in the Bible as we read through the entirety of the Bible, be it the Old Testament or later on in the days of the apostles, where you see, as we mentioned last time, Stephen, when he's brought before the Sanhedrin, and they ask him a question, is that so? And then it begins by telling the entirety of the story of Israel from Father Abraham, from his calling. And all of them are fully familiar with it, and so he's creating a familiar background where now he's no longer to them just that guy. You see? Now he's a member of their family, a member of their people. And so by creating this family relationship, family background, then it could come to the point. Of course, I didn't appreciate the end of the story. But that's a manner that is very customary in this society. And so a lot of things that you read in the Bible, you have to read it always with the context in mind, with the background in mind, and through their eyes of the people who are either telling the story or involved in it, you have to understand what is really going on and appreciating it from that point of view. A lot of people have a very difficult time understanding many things that they read because they're doing it with the eyeglasses of their own culture and their own society and their own age and their own feelings and emotions. And based on that, they pass judgment. Well, that's right or that's not right. Or I cannot understand it. Or some people would say that, well, I don't think that God will do this or I don't think God will do that. Well, what do we base that on? Our own thinking, our own opinions, our own culture, our own background? Obviously, this is not the criteria to judge any of these matters. And so that's what Eliezer is doing here, is establishing the background. And so we read in verse 34. Actually, in verse 33, he tells them, after they went through the customary hospitality acts, they fed his camels, his feet were being washed, and the ones that came with him, he was not alone. And so when that was done, now he has to tell the whole story. And so he tells them, after they gave him food, they put the food on the table, that is, of course they didn't eat on tables in those days, it was on the ground, but after everything was already there, this is what he says in verse 33, and there was set food before him to eat, but he said, I will not eat until I have told my errand. And that's the most important part of the business, he says. And so he said, speak on. And so everybody's now waiting, and he tells the whole story, and nobody eats. until it's all over. And so he said, I am Abraham's servant. Now he doesn't have to tell them his name. And that also was a custom of the Middle East, where probably to this very day in many parts of the Middle East, obviously not in the cities where things are already different, but still on the countryside, where this custom is still being maintained, especially when you have the tribes, families involved, and matters like that, and somebody comes from another tribe, and they may not know what tribe he is from, or what kind of relationship they have with him. And so in the beginning, he does not tell them his name until he eats. Once he eats, then he's a member of the family, so to speak, and now they have to treat him with respect. And the reason for that is if he is from a tribe where they had, let's say, family feud or matters of blood, in other words, they may have some problems with that tribe. In that case, if he tells them his name, they would know what tribe he's from, and they'll have to either, you know, chase him away or kill him, whatever it may be. And so the custom is, again, there. You don't tell your name until you eat. And after that, they have to treat him as a guest as long as he's in their house. And so this is also a part of the custom. When he says, I'm Abraham's servant, and they don't ask him, and he's not introducing himself by his name, because he's not the issue. And so he says, I'm Abraham's servant, and the Lord has blessed my master greatly, and he's become great, and he's given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and men servants and maid servants and camels and asses. So he's creating the background there, after which, when you hear that, nobody wants to, at this point, say no. You know? If this is the future of their daughter to be in that kind of life, obviously they're not going to say no. So he's with, you know, in wisdom and guidance and direction from God, and the wisdom that was in him, being the servant of Abraham, he knew how to bring about the matter to their attention, so there would be no resistance whatsoever to the matchmaking. And so he says in verse 36, and Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and unto him has he given all that he has. So now that makes the bridegroom extremely desirable for them. You see the wisdom behind it. And verse 37, and my master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, but he shall go to my father's house and to my kindred and take a wife for my son. And I said unto my master, peradventure the woman will not follow me. And he said unto me, the Eternal, that is Jehovah, before whom I walk, will send his angel with you and prosper your way, and you shall take a wife for my son of my kindred and of my father's house. And so they're hearing all these things, you know, and he's presenting a heavy case, you know, before them. And obviously, if there is any resistance, everything melts down. They know Abraham. They know his faith. They know that he walked with God. You see, they had tremendous respect for this man. And so they're not going to resist anything at this point. And so when the angel goes before him, when the wisdom of God is with him, when the favor of God is with him, you see, everything is done right, and he has to speak the right words and in the right order and at the right time. So you can see the whole thing is being orchestrated there, ultimately speaking, from above. And when those things are done, obviously everything is going to be successful. And oftentimes we don't realize that, because we're in a society today where we got so used to it, especially in the last century, where we do things on our own and we don't think in this manner. And so God is not involved. His angels are not involved, you see. And we do our own things, you know, we make our own decisions and we choose our own mates. And you see the end results of that. As Solomon was saying, you know, with all the experience that he had with so many wives, that he that finds a wife, A good wife, that is, he said, finds a good favor from the Lord. You see, when God is in it, that marriage, that relationship is not going to come apart. And yet, this is not the case, unfortunately, with the overwhelming majority of many of us. So that's something to learn from. And so he says to them about the divine providence here, which means that, in essence, it's not really up to them to resist, since God is involved in it, his angel is there, and so everything is being prepared in that direction for them to just very plainly say yes, and enthusiastically yes. And so in verse 31, he continues what Abraham tells him, "Then shall you be clear from my oath when you come to my kindred, and if they give her not to you, you shall be clear from my oath. And I came this day unto the fountain and said, O Eternal, the God, that is Elohim of my master Abraham, if you do prosper my way, which I go," you see, so he always makes it very plain to them that it's not something that I'm doing, it's not something that Abraham, the God of heaven that they too worship, of course they got the problems also worshiping other gods, fortunately that's the way the children of Israel also were. They worship the God of heaven, they worship the God of Israel, and also on the side, you know, they had their own gods. It was not total faith. And when you think about it, we're not different today in many ways. A lot of people know God, they believe in God, they even go to, you know, you find them in not only in the, among the body of believers, you see, the people that call themselves churches of God, but you find them among Protestants and Catholics, you know, good men, sincere men, and go to services, you know, go to church, whatever they call it, and basically live a good life, humanly speaking, decent life, righteous life, but also they have their gods. You see, they have their ideas, they have their concepts, they have their doctrines, they have their desires in this life, money, it could be, you know, or sex, or alcohol, or, you know, food, or whatever it may be. You see? And so, on one hand, they worship God, on the other hand, they've got their own gods, too. Now, this is where we find ourselves here, too. And so, he wants to impress on them the ultimate authority who is in it, and therefore they should not resist it, and whatever other thoughts or feelings they have, they should lay those things aside. And verse 42, he says, "And I came this day unto the fountain and said, O Eternal, the God of my father," that is, the God of my master Abraham, "if you do prosper my way, which I go, behold, I stand by the fountain of water. Let it come to pass that the maiden that comes forth to draw, to whom I shall say." So he's asking something very specific, so he would know. And we can be specific with God oftentimes when we walk with him in total faith, in total obedience. You see, he could not have said all those things unless he himself was obedient to God and having the faith in God that whatever you ask him, as Christ said, "Whatever you ask in my name, I will do, and the Father will do." You see? But all that is in the context of total obedience and in the context of the will of God being done there. And so this is what he's asking God for, something very specific. "So the woman, the maiden that comes forth to draw, to whom I shall say, give me, I pray you, a little water from your pitcher to drink, and she shall say to me, both drink you, and I will also draw for your camels. Let the same be the woman whom the Eternal has appointed for my master's son." And that was the specific matter that he asked for. "Yes, I will ask her for water," and that was a custom. You know, you are hospitable to strangers, you give them a drink. But he wanted something more than that, to make it very specific, that she herself would volunteer to also take care of his camels. "And before I had done speaking to my heart," so that's how he prayed, "behold, Rebekah came forth with her pitcher on her shoulder, and she went down unto the fountain and drew, and I said unto her, let me drink, I pray thee. And she made haste and let down her pitcher from her shoulder and said, drink, and I will give to your camels drink also. And that came directly from her heart. He did not even have to mention that. And that was a sign. And again, that's the way people in those days understood and comprehended and found out, and that's how they used to observe and check out and see what is in the heart of people. Are they hospitable? Are they generous? Certain things that they would do will determine that, and this was one of them. And a person who is like that, obviously this is a good match for Isaac, you see. And for that matter, you know, when parents wanted a good match for their own sons or daughters, this was a good place to go to the well, where you can interact, and you see the way they treat their animals, you see the way they converse, you see the way they treat each other, you see their manners. And this is not a place, you know, where people put on. Everybody's tired, you know, they come from the field. And so when they get to that place, this is where they prove their character. And also by that behavior that you see in them, since people knew each other in those days, you also knew what family they come from. You see, they would tend to emulate and exhibit the traits of their own family. And so this is what he was watching for, and he saw that everything was just exactly as he was praying for. And so the character of this woman was determined by that. That makes her a good match for Isaac. Verse 47, he said, "And I asked her and said, 'Whose daughter are you?' And she said, 'The daughter of Betuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore unto him.'" And Nahor was the brother of Abraham. "And I put the ring upon her nose." Today you would think it's strange, you know, you see people walking around with rings on their nose, and you say, well, those are crazy people. They don't know what to do with themselves. And because, you know, the society hasn't done it for many, many centuries, maybe thousands of years, then something becomes very weird. But then when you see everybody doing it, you know, it becomes normal. And that's the way we function, you see. We oftentimes judge what is right and what is wrong based on our culture, based on what we do or what we don't do. And based on that, we determine what is right, what is wrong. And oftentimes when people go to the Bible, that's the way they do it too. Well, they have an example. Because all the children of Israel used to do that. Not only women. You know, men also had earrings on their ears. And today when we see that, you know, we think there is something strange about this guy. We should examine ourselves and see, you know, where our concept and attitude comes from when we see this kind of things. So of course, we're not used to it, and it looks strange and weird. And, you know, we immediately put down that person, and that's how we judge them in their character. And sometimes, you know, those kind of things may have to do with really wrong attitudes or wrong examples or whatever it may be. But we have to consider the whole matter when we see these kind of things. By itself, there's nothing wrong with it. Even when the women, after a long time, when they didn't have earrings on their ears, and then one day they start putting earrings on their ears, a lot of people looked at it and thought, well, that's crazy. And then you get used to it. And the first time somebody put pants on, you know, when people were used to wear robes, you know, somebody, you know, thought, you know, that guy is weird. He's got pants on. And then you get used to it, and then everybody wears it. And that's how fashion is. As some say, the matter of taste and matters of beauty and matters of the senses, you cannot really discuss those kind of matters and determine what is right, what is wrong. Or as Paul would put it in other words, the matters of love, against such there is no law. This is one example of this. And so he put a ring on her nose, and the bracelets upon her hands, and I bowed my head and prostrated myself before the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me to the right way to take my master's brother's daughter for his wife. And now, if you will deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, tell me. In other words, let's settle the matter before we eat, so we don't have bad feelings after that. So it would not be out of constraint, you know. And so he says that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing proceeds from the eternal. You see, the whole matter was already laid to rest. He made it very plain. It's not just Abraham, it's not just the riches, and you know, it's far beyond that. God himself, and of course there was faith there still in these people. And so they understood and comprehended where it comes from. And today, we just don't think this kind of thoughts, generally speaking, unless we are brought up in this kind of culture, in this kind of society, in this kind of thinking, where God is involved in the lives of people. And you will see throughout this family later on, even when Jacob comes back later on to this very family and he marries Rachel and Leah, you see all of them constantly acknowledging God, like the daughters of Laban. They acknowledge God in everything that happens in their life, in the children that come, in the names that they give them. And you see how God is very much involved in this family, because out of this family he's going to produce his bride, his nation, his people, his church, Israel, and for an eternal purpose. And so everything that is happening here is a very important detail that you read, and the whole story put together. And this is what they acknowledge. Okay, we comprehend it, we see it, yes, it's from God. So we cannot speak unto thee or unto you bad or good. It's beyond us. It's not up to us. God has already determined that, and let the will of God be done. And so they said, behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be your master's son's wife, as the Eternal has spoken. You see? So all of them are here in obedience to the God of heaven. And it came to pass that when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself down to the earth unto the Eternal. Now picture yourself being in this scene. When you think about it today, we are so far from it. You know, we don't behave this way. We don't think that way. We don't act that way. And yet the day will come when we'll go back to this kind of way of life, where people are going to be natural and their life is going to be so involved in their Creator, in His way of life, that all these things will seem to be very natural to us. Now then, if we see somebody like that coming to our home and behaving in this manner, you know, he bows down to the ground with his face there and gives God thanks, you know, we'll think, well, this guy is weird, strange. That's unfortunately what happens when we depart far away from God. Then our ways become right in our own sights, and the ways of God become weird and strange. So this is a good opportunity also, as we read through these matters, to examine ourselves, see how far we have departed from that. And why is it that God is not so near to us as many of us have the feeling? You know, God is not so near to us as He used to be with His people of old. Oh, that's the reason. We've departed so far that we have not even recognized it, how far we have strayed from Him as a nation, as a culture, as a society. And so our behavior is so far and so different. As God later on had to say about Ephraim, He said, He told him through the prophet Isaiah, Hosea, I believe, that He told him of His law, but my law seemed to him, you know, my words seemed to him as strange things. Well, when you depart from God and you're far away from Him, now His way seems to be strange. And then when you come back to Him, then your old way seems to be strange to you. And that's the way it goes. And so we read in verse 53, 9, the servant brought forth jewels of silver and jewels of gold. So, is now that it has been agreed upon, what comes out now is, in essence, the dowry. So it brings abundance of it. After all, he brought 10 camels with him. And all that was for a dowry and for the parents. That was a part of the custom. Of course, that's something else that today we're far away from it. That's something else that seems to be strange to us. A lot of people are still doing it to this very day in many parts of the world, not only in the Middle East, in India, and many places. And the servant brought forth jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment and gave them to Rebekah. And so that's her dowry from Isaac, a gift from Isaac. And in that sense, in accepting it, she's accepting the invitation for marriage. And at this point, she's bound according to the law, according to the custom, according to the culture. You see, even though she hasn't seen him yet, once she has accepted that, she's already bound. And it is at this point that the law of marriage begins to take hold. And therefore, if at this point, when everybody knows and there have been a witness that she has accepted it, if she messes around, you know, with another man, it's already called adultery. Honor was extremely important to these people, and we departed from that nowadays. And so he gave also to her brother and to her mother precious things, and that's a part of the gifts and the reward that you give to the parents for all the work that they've done with this daughter. And it's done both ways, you know. In the society, they give, when they do a matchmaking, some people have sons, some have daughters, and when they need to take a mate on either side, they both exchange gifts, expressing their gratitude and reward for the hard work, for the upbringing, for the education, and for the loss they're going to have now in this marriage. And so that's a part of the custom also. And verse 54, and they did eat and drink. After all that, this is when they begin to eat and drink, and now they have a feast. He and the men that were with him, and tarried all night, and they rose up in the morning, and he said, send me away unto my master. And her brother and her mother said, let the damsel abide with us a few days, at least 10. So then it was a shock, you know. Suddenly she's gone. And obviously he was not interested in that. The deal is finished. He's on his way. And so he said, after that she shall go, after 10 days. And he said unto them, delay me not, seeing the Eternal has prospered my way. So he's still reminding them, it is of God. And when things are done, that's it. Let's obey the will of God until the end. Send me away, that I may go to my master. In other words, that's the ease of God. You know, our master is waiting anxiously, and therefore, let's continue to obey God in this matter, since that was his will and was determined, and we have accepted it. Let's continue that way. And they said, we will call the damsel, and the word that is used for the damsel is Alma, the damsel. In other words, Alma is generally the age of a girl that she can be married. In other words, that's a marriageable age. And so while she was in that period of time, they called her the Alma. And obviously, if the society was decent and honorable, the Alma, this damsel, would be virgin. And generally speaking, that's the way it was. And our society, unfortunately, in the last century or so, there's an awful lot of corruption that the girl is still called Alma. She's at the marriageable age, but she's not a virgin. And so later on, when God gives a sign to King Ahaz, that's what Isaiah tells him, behold, the damsel, the Alma, shall bear a child. And does not say virgin. And so there is an argument here between the rabbis and the theologians of so-called Christianity about this point. Well, the Jews say, well, it doesn't say virgin there, it says Alma. You see, a young maiden or damsel. But unfortunately, the switch the word there for virgin, and that's probably what the Catholic Church, you know, who was in charge of the New Testament, the switch the word that was used Alma, when that was the scripture that was quoted, not virgin, and they made it virgin. And of course, she was a virgin here in this case, but not in the case that you see later on with Isaiah. Because after all, it's speaking about the wife of the prophet. And she is the one that gave birth to a child, and those children were real, and they were assigned to Israel. And that's what he says. You know, he went to the prophetess, and she bore a child. Anyway, that's a different story there. And verse 58, and they called Rebekah and said unto her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. And you can see her attitude, obedient to God, faithful, generous, kind, perfect match. And all these things are from God, and she's very inspired by it, obviously. And she's also a woman of faith. And so she's not resisting. And she said, I will go. And they went away, and they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant, and his men. And they blessed Rebekah, and said unto her, our sister, be you the mother of thousands, of ten thousands, and let your seed possess the gate of those that hate them. That is, they're under inspiration. They may not realize it, but they're under divine inspiration, and so they speak. And that's in essence what is happening here. And this matter, obviously, is from God, because this is what he's going to fulfill in the future. And so you see the total involvement of God here in every detail, even in the last greetings that they gave to their sister, or their daughter. And verse 61, and Rebekah arose, and her damsels, so you can see it's not a poor family. All of Abraham's family was very rich. They were mighty in the land. And so she lives with her maidens, we don't know how many, but it's an indication, the good family she's coming from. And Rebekah arose and her damsels and rode upon the camels, and of course also the damsels here, later on, of course it's not something that is recorded, but these very girls, obviously, they were virgins, they come with her, and they end up where she is, and they are given in marriage to the other young men that are there in the household of Abraham. And so this in essence also later on provided fresh blood into the family of Abraham. And so later on, when the sons of Abraham, that is the grandsons of Abraham, that is actually the children of Jacob, when they need wives, well, they have also here extra women that come from the family of Abraham. And of course some of them also married native girls, Canaanites. But generally speaking, as much as possible, you know, they stayed within the family. And so Rebekah rose and her damsels, and they rode upon the camels and followed the men. And the servant took Rebekah and went his way. And Isaac came from the way of Be'er Lehi Ro'i. Now, what is he doing here? You see, Be'er means well, and the name of it was Lehi Ro'i. And mind you, earlier, when Hagar, the wife of Abraham, was fleeing from her mistress Sarah, she ended up in a place where there was no water, and God had mercy on her, and opened an eye, so to speak, in the ground. That's why they call the well also an eye. And there she had water. And so that was the name of the place. And that was in the land of Beersheba. And that's exactly where Isaac was. And again, he met her by the well. As later on, Jacob would meet his future wife by the well. And so the custom was also, as we mentioned earlier, for the young men and women to meet by the well. And an awful lot of things happened in that place. And that's oftentimes also, they had celebration and dancing and parties and things like that, you know, to celebrate all kind of family celebrations. And this was a place where men and women from different families could meet each other and strike acquaintances and get to know each other. And that's how later on the matchmaking was done. While on other occasions, in strict societies, in those societies, they were not even allowed to address each other or talk to each other in other areas. It was separate. And so that's a part of this culture also. And so it says, for he dwelt in the land of the south, that is in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate, in other words, it was evening prayer time, in the field at eventide. And he lifted up his eyes, and there again you have a detail about the prayer, the hour of prayer, that later on you read about among the apostles, you know, the hour of prayer. Today we don't have that, generally speaking. Unless you go to the Jewish community or the Muslim community, they still have the hour of prayer. In the Protestant community, instead of the hour of prayer, it's the hour of lecture in most congregations. Unfortunately, the churches of God, having members coming from this background, they still do the same. They don't know much about the hour of prayer. We come and we sit down and we hear a lecture and somebody speaks. And then we will listen, and then we get up, you know, we have a few little songs here and there. That is so far from the knowledge and the way of life and the divine service and the hour of prayer. We have so far departed from it that to go back to this way of life or the hour of prayer, you know, would seem to be strange to us. Well, anyway, that's a different point that we discuss from time to time. And one of maybe later on we'll take some time and discuss the whole matter. What was the hour of prayer? And this is what Isaac is doing here. He's going for the evening prayer. There's the morning prayer, the evening prayer, and there is the morning. Later on, you read about the morning that is the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, and that was a part of it. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field at the eventide, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she alighted from the camel, so she knew that was the one. Obviously, she was asking questions, and that was a sign of respect. She came down from the camel, and she said unto the servant, "What man is this that walks in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "It is my master." And she took her veil and covered herself. Because, you see, a part of the custom is, which is to this very day, that, at least in some societies, that until the marriage, you do not have your eyes covered. That is, when you are in that process of marriage, that's when they cover their eyes. If there is no marriage in mind there, then it's not an issue. And so it's a part of the custom. That's what she's doing here. And in verse 66, we read, "And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done, and Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent." Obviously, an awful lot of things happen in between. You know, the scripture is just giving us the basics here. So the marriage takes place, and that's when he brings her to his mother's tent. And he took Rebekah, that means she became his wife. In other words, they had a marriage celebration, a wedding supper. A lot of people today are taking it for granted because of the way things are, and they don't even know when it started, that when you want to get married, you go to the priest, you go to the rabbi, you go to the minister, and you ask, you know, you counsel, and then he comes, and, you know, you go through a religious ceremony. All that, that's a recent phenomenon. That nowhere in the Bible would you ever find a thing like that ever happen, where a priest or a minister or a rabbi is involved in the marriage. Because that's a private matter between the parents. And what they do, they have a marriage celebration, yes, a wedding supper, but there is no religious ceremony there. There is no rabbi, there is no priest involved, and nobody stands there and says what God never said. And unfortunately, we still do it to this very day, with the minister or the pastor or whatever it may be, at least in the world that many of us are from, and says, "By the authority given unto me, by the court of heaven, I now pronounce husband, you know, pronounce your husband and wife." Well, he's speaking his own words, unfortunately. Nowhere in the Bible would he ever find that. There is no example, you see. But, you know, people develop customs, and they take it for granted, and then you know, inject their own thoughts and ideas into it, and then they claim that it is from God. And God does not appreciate too much people that claim speaking his name when he hasn't spoken. So it's one of those things that we do today, and we don't know where it came from. And when you investigate the essence of the religious ceremony, you realize that it's only about 600 years ago that the Catholic Church, seeing that there was an awful lot of abuse in the marriage, husbands did not fulfill the responsibility, you see, and until that point, none of them was married religiously. You know, they just went through the regular way of taking a mate and exchanging money and things like that, and then they had a wedding celebration and supper and all that, but there was no religious, so to speak, background there, and therefore they did not think of it as too important, you know. And that was unfortunate, and so the Catholic Church, you know, with good intentions, decided, that is the leadership, decided, you know, we are going to make that man responsible for his actions, to take care of his wife and his children, And so they say, well, from now on, and that's only 600 years ago, when you want to get married, you know, when you make that agreement among yourselves, you come to the doorpost of the church, and the priest is going to stand there, and he's going to be a witness, you see, to that wedding vow, to take care of her and care for her. That is biblical. A man has to do those things, and they have a document where he signs the document, but that's between him and her, and between the parents on both sides, and no religious leader is present or involved in that. It has nothing to do with that. This is a private ceremony that God never asked any of his priests or ministers or rabbis or whatever it may be, you know, to be involved in that. And so that's what they did. But then they realized some men still, in spite of the witness of the priest, that after that could have some kind of spiritual leverage on that marriage, still many were not fully appreciative of that. And therefore, they said, and it took about 200 years, they said, and from now on, you come inside the church, and there, you are going to say that, and make that vow, and we're going to be witnesses. And gradually it became where the priest took over, and he himself initiated the whole thing, and he himself went through what they created as a ceremony, and then it became practice of the custom, you know, a custom of the society, and pretty soon people didn't even know where it came from, and they took it for granted. That's the way you get married. And so after that, then you had to ask for, for the marriage, that you have to ask for the church, so to speak, to either put together the marriage or put it apart, you know, annul it, or whatever it may be, or, you know, get permission for divorce in those congregations where they allowed it. Well, it's a side point here, but it's interesting to see how things develop from, as Christ would say, in the beginning it wasn't so, to the way that things become, and then becomes a part of the society and law of the society. And now we take it for granted that's the way it is. But you see, in a society where everybody's honest, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. That's what Christ said. And based on that, that's how they made the marriage agreement. And there were witnesses, and so responsibility was taken after that. And honor was extremely important. But, you know, when honor is not important, unfortunately, even when you go through this whole ceremony that is not from God, that is a religious one, that is, even then people are not honest, so that didn't do them any good. And so, in that sense, you might say, as Christ said about swearing, you know, swear not at all, even though it's according to the law, you should swear by the name of God. You know, he says, swear not at all, because you're not honorable people. Now, don't even mention the name of God or by anything. You know, just say yes and no. At least you're not going to blaspheme God that way, taking the name of God in vain. And so it is when it comes to marriages. Had he addressed this issue today, probably would have said the same thing, you know. Don't even go to the rabbi, don't even go to the priest, don't even go to the minister, because they're going to invoke the name of God, and you're not going to obey it anyway. Just say yes and say no, and that's it. Well, one of these days we're going to see quite a few changes in our way of life when we totally depart from the ways of the world and come back to the ways of God. And then this is what we read here. He took Rebecca, you know, he went through the marriage supper, and then obviously the sexual part of it, that was the consummation of the marriage, and she became his wife, and that's how she becomes a wife. And so later on you read the law. When a man comes unto a woman and takes her to be his wife, and that was the extent of it. And in most cases, obviously, they had the wedding supper. In some cases, when they went to war, it was not as elaborate. He just liked someone, he took her, and she became his wife. And that's how the marriage becomes valid. And so she became his wife, and he loved her, and Isaac was comforted for his mother. So he was mourning. She just died not too long ago. And now that he had another woman in his life, obviously that was a great comfort to him. And in essence, Rebecca now is replacing the big gap, the big hole, you know, that was left in his heart by the loss of his mother that he loved. And now she's in essence fulfilling the role of his mother and also the role of the wife, obviously. And all that, from the beginning until the end, was from God. And now in chapter 25, the story goes back to Abraham himself, his private life. Now Isaac has a wife, and she is in Sarah's tent. You see? So in essence, the wife of the house is gone, and Rebekah is replacing Sarah. And so all that becomes the territory of Isaac, so to speak, and Isaac is a center figure that we find here. Well, Abraham is now by himself. His wife is no longer in that tent, and yet he's still in good health. And so in chapter 25, we basically, we read in the beginning of it, the story of Abraham and how he continued his life and all the blessings that also God gave him in terms of the rest of his life and having a wife and children. And since we are reaching the end of the tape here, we're going to stop at this point. And this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. And next time we'll continue from chapter 25.